welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature Interviews. Today I have a fabulous guest, Aaron Peacock, whose film Carvey's Long Halloween, and it was filmed half an hour from my house, so that makes me happy. Welcome to the show.
How are you doing? I didn't know you were half an hour from me, so there you go. We'll talk about it after.
Yes, we can talk about it after. Yeah, I only know because I read one of these strange reviewers that actually watches credits.
Right.
Because I think it's important to watch credits because I learn things sometimes. Sometimes I know, sometimes I do, but I like watching credits. So I saw where it's filmed. I'm like, okay, I know exactly where you are.
Very cool.
But I don't really want to discuss that, so that's fine.
That's fine.
Was this filmed in color then switched to black and white?
Yes, well, sort of. So the file that comes out of the camera, we shot on a Blackmagic Pocket 4K.
Okay.
File that comes out of the camera is a color file, but we were shooting with a lookup table that was black and white while we were shooting, so that we got a sense of like what the black and white values were while we shot. We chose the Blackmagic 4K because we could shoot in the, and I'm struggling now to remember the exact frames per second we used, but it's the frames per second that silent films are inaccurately adhered to, and that's why it makes them look jumpy. So we wanted to recreate that sort of jumpy silent film look. And so, yes, it was filmed in color, but black and white, even as we were recording it, that's what we saw. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, I want to start off, you have this lovely musical track, which we will get into more later.
Yeah.
I want to say, did you guys know what music you were using before you shot the short? Because it's so important music for this short.
So a little bit of it. So a lot of it is Claude Debussy music pieces. And I'm a big fan of his because of his time period, which I believe is sort of the late 1800s into the early 1900s. And his sound, very influential on movie soundtracks and on movie scoring. Like if you listen to some Debussy pieces, you'll hear the origins of the Star Trek theme. You'll hear the Jaws theme. You'll hear Bernard Herrmann stuff from Hitchcock. And so, yes, totally. At least for the first few tracks, I have a friend of mine, Nathan Wisnicki, who is like a computer filled with classical music information. And he's got a credit as the music consultant, I believe. And he was able to, I'd say, I need something that sounds like this piece from this Hitchcock movie. And he'll like flip through his Rolodex in his head and give me pieces. And then what happened is once we sort of laid in those Debussy pieces, I started saying, I need some contemporary stuff to him that will sound like it all fits together. And then he handed me three or four other pieces. And that's how we ended up with our Wagner later on. And then, you know, the piece that ends it. And I should know all the composer's names, so I feel like I'm letting you down there. But yes, it's all from that time period. Yeah.
Okay. Now, my question is, your film and this are like timed succinctly. I was so impressed that I felt the music was telling the story as we went. Now, that's why I was wondering why you picked certain music pieces, because I'm like, it's like they filmed to the music.
Well, we really did focus on the music and we thought about it a lot. Like, I believe the first piece has a title like Children at Play, and it's when everybody's trick or treating.
Yes.
So it does totally match that. One of the things, and I wish my producer, my editor, Aiden Kennedy was here to tell you about this, but we talk a lot about, because we do a lot of corporate work, about it, you can up the production value of whatever it is you're doing, whether or not it's a short film or, you know, a piece for a burger restaurant. If you understand like the basic structure of a song, if you know where like a bar ends in a song, then you know that you can take the final bar of the piece and stick it on the song and kind of cheat that all the way through. So a lot of probably what you're hearing is all those little tricks that we've learned from 10 years of doing corporate work, sort of, you know, making it smooth and telling the story that way. Yeah.
I thought it was great. I thought it worked so well and I was shocked by it. I will honestly say how well it worked for me as a viewer. I was like, wow, yeah, this awesome. Is really fun. And cool. I also want people to state, you have no talking. There is nothing ever said to this other than old silent film cards, which made me so warped that somebody else loves silent film as much as myself.
I would say the only voices you hear in the whole movie is that we do a Colin Carvey theme song set to the tune of Frère Jacques that my nieces sang, and that was really great. Okay.
You want to get into that now? Fine. At the end of the film, you do introduce your first voice work, I will say. So that was your niece singing the song.
It was my girlfriend's niece's, yes. And so she went with her phone, actually, and they each demanded to be paid $5, so that we spent $10 on that song.
Wow,
and,
good work.
And they really know how to drive a bargain, and they recorded that for us. Yeah.
Now, who wrote the song? You did?
Yeah, I wrote the song, and we knew that we were going to try to find like a royalty free piece of like, you know, folk, so kids folk song to use at the end. So yeah, I wrote the song. Yeah.
So how do people react at seeing the movie? I mean, myself, I was like, oh my God, there's voice finally. It changed the whole perspective to me. Do you get that one during screenings?
When the voice happens at the end, is that what you mean? Well, yes. So here's the funny thing. So we've had like a pretty great festival run. We played Fantasia in Montreal. We played Toronto After Dark in Toronto. We played Monster Fest in Australia, and we are due to play Fog Fest in Newfoundland. All this is to say is that I've seen it with a few audiences now, and we were lucky enough actually in Montreal at Fantasia to win the Silver Audience Award. So very positive reaction. However, that song at the end, the laugh from the end of the movie and the clapping from the end of the movie completely overtook the song. So I don't know if anybody heard the theme song in Montreal at all.
What is really funny, I was at Just for Laughs during Fantasia, and I am every year. Really? So I'm always, I've never go to Fantasia, and I'm there every year at the same time. That's just funny that we're so close to each other, never run into each other.
It's funny they booked them at the same time.
Montreal is just a city full of festivals 24/7. Sure. So let's back up a bit and go to costuming.
Sure.
Like, love them. Absolutely. It looks like you spent some time looking for different things, and from headdress to crossing guard costumes to fishing guys costumes. Like, everybody seems to, I would say, a unique look. So how long did you take you to do all that?
Well, I would say that the first thing that we did that I think was really strategic and helped us out a lot when it came to costumes is we decided we were making a Halloween movie, and we decided that some of that Halloween movie would be shot in the month leading up to Halloween. So that means that Halloween costumes were on the shelves, and we could take them and sort of like make them our own and repurpose them. And you'll notice that some of those costumes you're talking about, so you're talking about a police officer and you're talking about a fisherman, they're sort of like, you know, classic looks. But yes, we did try to add specific things to give it sort of a 1930s vibe so that it fit with the silent film, you know, style, right? And in the case of the fisherman, we actually went to a local antique store and bought the rod and the reel. And so that's like an authentic, you know, I don't know what, probably 1940s rod and reel. It's made out of wood. And then when it came to the policeman, we got everything. Pretty much everything from a modern police officer can be sort of ported over, with the exception of the big coat. And luckily, the guy who played the police officer who also played Satan, I'll give that away to your audience.
Oh, there we go.
He brought us the coat, and then we added sort of, there's these ringlets on old style police officers' coats that really sold it, I think, because it's just that accoutrement.
Yes.
When it comes to Colin, though, when it comes to that costume, we looked at a lot of costumes from the turn of the century. Here's a little known fact. Did you know that trick or treating, and not necessarily invented here, but the term trick or treat was first recorded in Canada? I learned this not too long ago.
I did.
In
not 1912. Know that.
So when you look back at the history of trick-or-treating you just know that Canada is connected to that. But the point is that I was looking at all these old photos, and we were looking at basically homemade Halloween costumes from that era. And the whole burlap sack over a head is just it's connected to mummering in Newfoundland, and it's connected to guising, which was what trick-or-treating was in like Ireland before it was pagan, and then it became Christian and all this, right? So it's like basically throwing anything on that you can, you know, find around you and making it work. And so that's why Colin Carvey is a costume maker and a good boy. Yeah.
I got to have a question. How much can he see outside that mask? I mean, obviously a lot of it's you shooting over and over again.
Right.
I mean, according to the film, by basing on film, he can see fairly well.
Right.
But I want to know in reality how well he's seeing out of that costume.
He didn't see much. So the way that his costume, for the listeners, I'll describe it quickly. He's got like a big burlap sort of pumpkin shaped head with little demon ears or horns, and then like kind of bulbous eyes and a kind of a rictus grin on the front, right? But it's made out of burlap and with a rope around the neck. And so the way we actually constructed that, we tried a few things. We tried to get a hat that like a wide brimmed hat and then put the burlap over the hat, but you could never keep the shape. And what we eventually, it was a bit of a cheat again. But again, the beauty of shooting right around Halloween is we went to Walmart and we bought one of those big kitty hats, the big like kitty heads that are oversized.
Yes,
and so what it is, it's the burlap sack over the kitty head. And so it just immediately took shape and I went, well, that was easy. It was a freebie. And that's how we made it. And then when it comes to the visibility, you could see pretty well through the kitty's eyes, cause that's what it's made to do, but then there's burlap and eyes over top of that, so there was limited visibility. Luckily we didn't put him in the river or anything. He was in fields and stuff like that for the most part.
Yeah, it was just kind of funny sometimes. I'm like, they would literally you have to position your actor the way you wanted him to go.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. I'm thinking a lot of the scenes when he's moving items, usually the same item, that you really have to push, okay, we need you to walk forward now. And I mean, yeah, I can see that. I'm not blaming you, but I was expecting that.
Well, the real challenge is the sort of premise of the thing is that Colin gets glued into his Halloween mask by bullies, and he goes to try to find help on Halloween night. And then every time he tries to attempt to find help, he ends up accidentally murdering or maiming somebody. It's like a Looney Tunes short, because it's like a setup, and then something really gruesome is the punchline, right? And the one instance that really kind of pertains to what you're saying is there's one gag with the fisherman where the reel goes over a tree branch and it hooks onto the mask, and that took a lot of time to figure out because he's got this string behind him and we have to see it. But the thing was that Taylor, who played the part, Taylor Beatty, I sent him home with a Buster Keaton set of Blu-rays and a Charlie Chaplin set of Blu-rays. And let's put it this way. I think he only watched them at 4:20 in the afternoon. But anyway, that's fine. He sat there and he experienced Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, maybe the best way you can at this point. And he just absorbed it. And he brought all that physicality to it. There are two shots in the movie where it's not him in the costume because we just didn't have him. And we struggled because we could not live up to like the exact movements that he was doing. He brought so much to it. And it's like one of those things where like you're really kind of delighted and surprised by a performer because they bring so much to it and you didn't expect it, right?
Hold on. I can't let that go by. Are you going to tell me the two scenes he's not in?
I'm more than happy to tell you the two scenes.
I would love to hear which two because I think I know one of them.
Okay, so one of the scenes is he knocks an old lady, or an old lady is riding a bicycle and runs off the road.
That's a very quick cut.
And there's a follow-up scene where he's up on the hill, and that's not him. And you can tell if you look closely because he's much taller. And Taylor is not a man of like of extreme stature in this part of the
movie. You cut that scene so fast. The hill scene. The woman falls. It's a cut to the hill, and you're gone.
Right, right.
Those are the scenes that it's a quick cut off that hill, I would say. I really don't get it shot.
Yeah, it's him on the hill, and then there's one where he runs from the police officer the police officer up until the cook. And there's just a moment where it's not him because we needed, well, you know what happened is we shot this over the course of about 3 months on like whenever we could get the people available. And so we started in the summer, but what we realized as we reached it premiered actually at an event in Port Hope where it was shot. And it's an arts event that goes on November 1st, and everybody brings their pumpkins, and everyone lights their pumpkins for the last time, their jack-o'-lanterns. So we showed it on the wall there. The arts organization that puts it on is called Critical Mass. The point being is that as we reached that, we realized we should go back and get some shots where you could see leaves on trees and leaves that were decaying, because then it would set it in the right time of year, even though our early stuff is quite clearly summer if you know where to look for it. So that's why that shot happened later and without Taylor, because we needed some leaves. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
I want to discuss the strange assortment of candy that this picks up. Who likes candy corn? Like, who actually gives that out? And what is that ball? Like some popcorn ball, maybe?
So you're going to love this, I think, because this I'm going to use this to then jump into a second story as well, because it's tangentially connected. So the candy, if I remember correctly, is candy corn. It's a popcorn ball, which is basically a Rice Krispie square made with popcorn. It's an apple and it's an old timey soda. So the reasoning behind that is because I wanted it to all be candy that existed in the 30s.
That's right.
And the popcorn ball. Yeah, exactly. The popcorn ball was my dad's mom, my paternal grandmother. That was what she made on Halloween, which is, by the way, a terrible Halloween candy, but it connected to that time frame because she was a little kid in the 30s. It's sort of like a personal touch. But the story that I wanted to use this as a jumping off point into is that the one of the things that's going on underneath in this whole movie, which sort of comes off as a pretty straightforward horror comedy, right? Or what we like to call it is a darkly comic silent film slasher. That's how we describe it. But the thing that's going on underneath is sort of inspired by my grandmother on the other side, my maternal grandmother, who was a staunch Catholic. And so things like ghosts and goblins were not discussed in the house. However, Halloween was always an opportunity to do that. So there's sort of a thing from my childhood. I was churched to a certain extent as well. That's running through this, which is that, you know, good boys get to be bad on Halloween. And I wanted to make sure I mentioned that, because that's like that's the deep theme that I'm not sure everybody's going to get, but it's the sort of stuff that when you really love what you're working on, you work that into it to make it personal. You know what I mean? Oh,
of course. At any time, was this film not going to be a silent film?
Well, yes. So the story I tell at all the film festivals, you get to hear it here. So this film, it was originally going to be called Almost Halloween. And it had two titles, Almost Halloween, and then it eventually it was called Dana Carvey's Long Halloween. And the joke was that it was going to be about, it's basically the same premise. Somebody gets glued into the Halloween costume. But what I had done is I'd bought the Dawn Post Spock mask instead of the Dawn Post Kirk mask. And I turned it into a Halloween. In fact, I'm going to show you, because I know your listeners won't hear this and you can cut it out, but I'm going to show you anyway.
I'm not cutting it out. So you're out of luck.
I'm not cutting it out. So nope. You can see it. There he is. So I actually did this and we just didn't go with it. So there's Spock done up like Michael Myers. But the gag was that at the end of the whole movie, you would discover that his name was not Michael Myers. It was Dana Carvey. So you got Mike Myers, Dana Carvey. And I thought, well, that's a pretty precious joke. I don't know if that works for everybody. And it was sort of, when I was conceiving it, it was meant to be sort of an ad for our company, Two Blue Shirts Productions. Like, once a year, we like to do something on Halloween, and it gets a lot of people involved from town and stuff. But it wouldn't stand on its own. And sort of around the same time, we started working with a really great organization called the Marie Dressler Foundation in Coburg. And they have a museum called the Marie – pardon me?
He has a house.
You're familiar. Yes, the Marie Dressler House. So it's now a museum dedicated to women in film history, prominent women in film history. So Marie Dressler, Norma Shearer, Faye Ray, I think, is getting a piece. And I'm not remembering everybody. But anyway – we started getting into watching a lot of vintage film and silent film and sort of classic movies, and I was becoming really enamored with the square aspect ratio of the time, like the Academy square aspect ratio. And so I kept saying to Aiden while I was talking about this, we could do a silent film, and it could be an exercise in sort of like teaching us the very basics of film grammar again. It's like conjugating the verbs, but it'd be a fun way to conjugate the verbs, right? And he said, well, why don't we make the Halloween movie silent? And I went, you brilliant bastard, you. So that was his idea. I don't know. He sometimes tries not to take credit for it, but it was his idea. And then the beautiful thing about a silent film is all of a sudden, when you need 60 people to be extras in it, they don't have to have lines, and they just have to overact to the camera, because that's what it looks like anyway. And so suddenly people are really excited to be involved. So that's why we had such a great, big, expansive background cast as well.
Okay. I do want to discuss a couple locations.
Sure.
The old warehouse, I couldn't figure out where that was in Port Hope. I mean, maybe I've never seen this, what I'm thinking.
So
where he does with the two cooks are outside, and you got something running over it. I know it's by Olympus Burger or whatever that place is. It's right near there, but I don't know where.
So it is Olympus Burger. That's what Olympus Burger looks like behind.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. So the guy.
So you're at the back chef, of the place.
We're at the back of the place, and I wanted to get the train tracks in there because it gave us really good production value. And then the chef is George Kalanakis, who owns Olympus Burger. I used to work for his parents back in the day when they
owned. That's the only place I could think of where that shot was. But I'm like, there's no warehouse there that I can tell.
No, they just have they had a bunch of stuff there in the winter, in the summer, because they do they have people come in and like do smoked meat and stuff. So there's like, you know, like boxes of stuff back there. So we went, free production value, take it wherever you can, right?
Okay, the park, I presume, is right across from there in the park.
So actually, that park is what's it called? It's the park that's down along the river, right up to Jocelyn Street. It's called, is it Optimus Park? Maybe I can't remember the name of that park, but there's a ball diamond there. The ball diamond we shot at was actually out in Welcome, but no, it's not across, but it was down the street, and we specifically picked that spot because it had the old picnic table.
I know exactly where Welcome is. We're good.
Yeah.
People are like, what are they talking about? I'm like, just small towns you never need to go to.
Well, the best part of this, and I don't know if you're going to go this way with it, but it's a great piece of trivia, I feel, so I'll tell you anyway.
Oh, I love it.
So Port Hope is where Andy Muschietti shot the It movies, the last two Stephen King movies. So two of our locations are actually It locations. So Aiden's mom runs the shoe store that was converted into the butcher shop in the It movies. So the alleyway we are in is the alleyway from all – like the alleyway in both It movies where all the Losers Club is standing. So there's the alleyway where the secret screening is. If we had panned the camera a little bit farther to the left, you would have seen the dairy mural that Warner Brothers has left in the town. But we went, okay, well, let's avoid that just because there's some sort of copyright issue. And then all of our green screen stuff, we actually shot in the shoe store because we needed a spot big enough that we could use. And it just so happened the shoe store is not open on Sundays, which is when our actor was available. So this was, you know, serendipity. So we gutted the middle of the shoe store and we'd set up green screen, and that's where we shot all of Hell and some of the stuff on the bike, all the reprojection stuff, like anything that was processed, we shot in there. Wow. So we stole the location from Warner Brothers.
I did want to get into the bike riding scene anyway. It looks like it was a weird shot for you. It looks like it was shot at two different days.
Well, it was all one day, but I going to try and remember the name. I was really inspired by a very early use of rear projection in a silent film. And I think the silent film, it's like something like The Air Pirates, but it's not a lost film, but there's no good version of it. I think you can find it on YouTube. But it was like the first example of where they put like a plane in front of a rear projection screen and they shot stuff out of the side of the plane and stuck it behind there. And I thought, I want to do that, and I want it to look just as artificial as a silent film. Okay. So that's why you kind of get that disconnect that I think that's what you're talking about.
That's because exactly what I'm talking about.
Try to make the rear projection look perfect. It wasn't meant to. It was meant to look like somebody had done it in 1925. You know,
perfect. I mean? Then you hit it. Yes, you got exactly what I was looking for on that one. I got blood or acid on people. So basically the owner of Olympus Burger gets a shot. You use the same shot over and over again, the blood shot. Now, how is that done? Because it's like a blood splattering, and I don't think it's makeup. I think it's somebody blowing through a tube.
So there's the acid shot with George, which is just a simple cut where all the acid was done by sticking incense into the bucket, so it looked like there was smoke going.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay.
We were just trying to be low key, right? Like I have a smoke machine. We could do some basic pyro stuff, but we weren't going out to get permits. And we also thought, let's not throw a fire behind a restaurant or someone's going to show up right away. Right. So it was all as subtle as we could be. We stuck incense under the camera and that's how you get the acid. The other blood shot, which is like sort of our Evil Dead blood shot, I think is the one you're thinking about, which is on the ball diamond.
Yes.
So what we did is there's a super soaker that has two nozzles at the end that flop around. And I knew I didn't need just like a single shot from a super soaker because I knew that would just look like artificial, right? But I knew that if I could get those two kind of waving nozzles. So I went and looked and found the super soaker with the nozzles. And the best part of it is that the couple in that scene, Mike Mooring, who is a filmmaker from Peterborough, great guy, and that's his partner, Taylor Bloom. We had a Taylor Beattie and a Taylor Bloom, just to be as confusing as possible. But Taylor Bloom, it was Mike who got to shoot Taylor in the face with the blood. And we are both Evil Dead Sam Raimi fans from way back. So it was like, you know, childhood giddiness on that day when we got the sprayer.
Excellent. Did you have any issues working with the green screen?
Issues working the green screen? Not so much. It's a pretty simple comp that we did. We do a lot of heavy backlighting so you can get around it. But again, it's one of those things where, like, even if you look at the movie, you might think, well, that green screen's not perfect, but it's also not meant to be perfect, right? It's meant, you're meant to think, oh, we've double printed things. Like we did a trick, for instance, where hell is made up of all these elements, but we also put like a separate grain layer on hell so that you would sort of imagine it as if they double printed it, you know, back in the 60s or something, so that one element looks crappier than the other element. It sort of bounces around. So no issues, but the whole movie was designed, and I don't want to say to make it easy, but strategically is how I put it. It was designed so that we would get exactly what we wanted.
Okay. I only have one more last question about the film, and this one's the easiest one I have for you.
Sure.
Two Blue Shirt Productions. What does that mean?
Oh, okay. So this is good. I'm happy that you asked this so I get to tell this. So Aiden, my business partner, and I, we met working at Blockbuster, the Port Hope Blockbuster, about 15 years ago, and we wore blue shirts. So that's why it's Two Blue Shirts. And there was a moment we used to do inventory. And the way inventory works at Blockbuster is people are given guns to scan the barcodes on each disc, and then it sends a signal to the computer. And sometimes you have to call out the number to somebody at the computer to double check. So you scan and you do a double check by calling the number. And what would happen is they put Aiden on one side of the store and they put me on the other. And instead of yelling out the actual titles to movies, we would yell out the porn titles. So I would say Deep Impact. So that was actually the title, but that's an easy one. Or he would say the Poseidon Adventure, right? And we would laugh and laugh and laugh. And in that moment, we went, there's the sense of humor. We were connected there. And so when we both finished school, I went to Humber. He went to Loyalist. I said to him, I don't really want to have a boss. And he said, I don't really want to have a boss either. So we started our company. And that was about 12 years ago.
Wow. So one of you guys went east, one of you guys went west.
Yeah, but we both circled back on weekends and stuff. So we saw a lot of each other, and then that's how that came to be, yeah.
Okay. I think I've covered your film pretty good, but I do have three fun questions left.
Sure.
Which I think you've listened to an interview. I have this odd feeling that you were prepared, but maybe not.
I've done some podcasts myself, too. We can talk about that after, too.
We can. Yeah. Favorite film?
Favorite film. I like to give a two-part answer. I'm going to say The Graduate and Raiders of the Lost Ark, to give you sort of the idea of where my two main influences come from. I like popcorn stuff that, you know, that's just as good as the best. That's Raiders. And The Graduate to me is like so soulful and funny and dark and influential on people like Wes Anderson, and basically like a whole, you know, a pile of independent filmmakers owe it to Mike Nichols and The Graduate. So that's why I love The Graduate.
I'm going to change my question because you told me you worked at Blockbuster. How many times did you talk people out of renting Pearl Harbor?
I don't know if I've ever talked them out of renting Pearl Harbor, but I will tell you this. This is an exclusive, okay? I've never seen Pearl Harbor.
Wow. So what film at Blockbuster would you not let people rent?
Would I not let people rent? Fat Albert came out around that time.
Oh,
and that even had nothing to do with the Cosby Connection. That was just a terrible movie anyway.
You are correct. Okay, last one. One actor you will work with in the future.
One actor I will work with in the future. So you want like a real big name actor and not somebody?
Well, no, you could be your buddy down the street. If that's what you feel is going to be your answer, I'm okay with that.
Well, I already worked with Taylor. He's my buddy down the street. I would say an actor who I would love to work with is Andrew Garfield. That guy has incredible range. I think that he's going to be, as he ages, and he ages out of just playing guys in their 20s, because he's 40, but he looks like he's 25, right?
Yes, actually.
He knows how to like take what's inside, really put it on his sleeve, and that'd be interesting to work with him.
Okay. Tell everybody they can find all your stuff.
You can find a lot of our stuff at www.twoblueshirtsproductions. That's all spelt out .com. I've got a couple of short films up there and a web series called Plague Time Puppet Theater that we did over COVID. That's not for the faint of heart. That's like South Park level debauchery. And then you'll also see all the stuff we do social media for all the businesses around here. So I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. Please check out our YouTube channel, and you can also support the show by going to PayPal. Thank you.